Welcome to the 70th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series titled Contact, Art and the Pull of Print, art historian Jennifer L. Roberts will focus on printmaking as an art of physical contact, involving transfer under pressure between surfaces, a direct touch that can evoke multiple forms of intimacy. And yet it is simultaneously an art of estrangement. It requires the deferral, displacement, and distribution of artistic agency, and it trades in reversal and inversion. In this second lecture, Reversal, premiered on the National Gallery's website on May 2, 2021, Roberts explores how every pre-digital print process produces some form of reversal. The entire history of printing is based on the reversal of information. Making prints thus requires a certain backwardness. The capacity to imagine things from the other side is compulsory. This is especially true for artists using text. An attunement to reversibility allows for unique ways of exploring communication and confrontation in bodily space.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in again. This is the second of six Mellon Lectures, and now that we're getting our bearings on our production routines, I want to take a moment to thank everyone at the National Gallery for organizing the rather complicated remote production of these lectures. Also, thanks to the Center for Advanced Study in the Visual Arts for supporting my work over the years. As I was preparing this lecture over the past week, I realized that the very first inklings of this project were developed for the Wyeth Lecture in American Art that I delivered at CASVA 8 years ago in 2013. So this has been a long time coming, and I owe a great deal to the National Gallery and CASVA for getting it all started and now completing it. So as I mentioned last time, in these lectures, I'm attempting to open up new ways of thinking about the significance of print and printmaking in the visual arts. I've organized the lectures not around specific artists or specific moments in print history or specific print media, but rather around a series of physical maneuvers that embody some of the most fundamental transformations that occur in the printmaking process. And these are, again, pressure, reversal, separation, strain, interference, and alienation. These terms function for me as a kind of primordial grammar of printmaking. I'm interested in this grammar because it creates patterns of connection between parts of the arts, humanities, and sciences that are usually isolated from each other. It's a grammar that's designed to be transitive, to open passages between the material and the social, and also to create paths for crossing between different media and different spheres of making. So between print and painting and sculpture, etc., but also between the fine arts and the decorative arts and the industrial arts and the domestic arts. We were able to see some of that last week when we looked into some of the surprising conceptual links that you can see between printmaking and ironing when you look at the idea of pressure. This week, today, we'll be testing this proposition through the operation of reversal. Every print made before the digital era is born of reversal. The exact manner of the reversal differs from process to process, from place to place, from past to present, but reversal is a fundamental maneuver of printmaking. In most cases, the conspicuous and culminating act of reversal in printmaking happens in the press, between the matrix and the impression. And here I just remind you that all prints are the results of contact between two surfaces. In all print processes in which the matrix is positioned face to face against the support, so this would include woodcut, engraving, lithography, most of the major traditional processes, the final print is a reversal of the matrix. The matrix is a reversal of the print, and I'll go into a few exceptions a little bit later. But basically the point is that if you want to make a print face a certain way, you have to create the matrix so that it faces the other way. This is a famous print by Rembrandt, The Raising of Lazarus, and its copperplate matrix. Note, of course, here the left-right or mirror reversal between these two images. This is a very good demonstration of the significance of reversal, as well as its disruptive capacity. Rembrandt was castigated at the time because whereas Christ was etched properly on the plate, with his right hand doing the work as it should, the print shows him raising Lazarus with his left hand. Almost every act of printing prior to the digital age, whether of text or image, whether in ancient China or Renaissance Italy or modern Britain, was also an act of reversal in this way. Everything that we evoke when we evoke print culture or the print revolution, the reproduction of images, the dissemination of beliefs, the communication of knowledge, the very properties of modernity, ultimately depends upon the reversal of information. A forgotten archive of reversals stands behind the vast majority of images and texts produced in modern history. It's a forgotten archive because these reversals don't usually reveal themselves out in the world where printed matter circulates. Once the print has been pulled from the press, the print moves on and the matrix stays behind. The mirror pair that is present at that moment of emergence from the contact event ends up vanishing from the scene of print culture and, I think, print studies. And so when we look at prints and books and newspapers and broadsides and so on, it seems to me that we see only one side of them. The more I've thought about this, the stranger it has seemed. It's as if we were zoologists studying only the right sides of animal bodies, or physicists studying only antimatter but not matter. When we look only at the print, but not its originating reversals, we miss a lot. We miss the way the print intersects with problems of symmetry and topology. We miss the way printmaking engages with the structure of the human body, our own organization around a central corporeal seam, and the way we fold ourselves up around that seam. We miss the way print's reversals open up hinges or folds or even pleats in spatial and social experience. And we miss the way print helps orient us to that experience. What would it look like to hold on to that deep awareness of reversal in printmaking and in art history? What would it look like to put it to work? This is what I hope to explore in this lecture. Now, I first became interested in print through the work of Jasper Johns, not only one of the greatest living contemporary artists, but also an artist for whom printmaking has driven his work and thinking in all media. One of the things that struck me about Johns from the outset was the way he allows the reversals inherent in printmaking to occupy his compositions so that they remain prominent in the finished print or often painting. We might say that he refuses to leave the reversed matrix behind in his work. In symmetrical compositions like Corpse and Mirror, shown here, Johns works as if to bring the matrix and the print back together. Indeed, throughout his work, what we might call the reverse intelligence of printmaking breaks through to the final image and breaks out into other media. This is a composition that for me really epitomizes what I would call printerly intelligence. Johns made it at Universal Limited Art Editions in 1976, working with master printer Bill Goldston. It's a print that you can almost see thinking about what it means to be a print. It's organized bilaterally, mirroring itself around a central seam, as if we were looking, again, at a print pulled away from its matrix. The title here is worth comment, Corpse and Mirror. The mirror part of the title is obvious, but the corpse is perhaps a little more puzzling. This refers to the bodily qualities of the composition, especially the way these bilateral symmetries tend to evoke bodies in the round simply through the act of symmetry. But more importantly, it refers to the surrealist drawing game known as the exquisite corpse. Those of you who know your surrealism will remember that to make an exquisite corpse, participants would collectively complete a drawing on sections of a folded piece of paper. One person would complete a section, then someone else would pick up at the fold and create another section without being able to see the previous drawing. Johns evokes this in the fold-like divisions in the work, and in doing so also emphasizes some other aspects of printing that we've already discussed, especially its blindness. In making an exquisite corpse, you don't see the final image until you unfold it at the end of the game. Same with printmaking. It's not until the pull, not until that reverse, that you see what the press has done. The connection to the surrealist game also highlights the collectivity of printmaking, the way no print can ever be completely attributable to the mind or hand of an individual artist. The mind of the print, we might say, exists somewhere in those seams between participants, between materials, between dimensions, between the world and its mirror. Johns has spoken extensively about the impact that printmaking has had on his other work. Here's a typical quote. Just the process of printmaking allows you to do, not allows you to do things, but makes your mind work in a different way than, say, painting with a brush does. And some of that feeds back into painting, because then you see, you find things which are necessary to printmaking that become interesting in themselves and can be used in painting where they're not necessary, but become like ideas. And in that way, printmaking has affected my painting a lot. In terms of reversal, we can see John's picking up on it like an idea in many of his paintings, like this one, Field Painting, which really works on the principle of the hinge. Hinged letters here perform the project of reversal. Notice how John's gives us text or letters both forwards and backwards. And he also conveniently leaves in the painting the imprinting objects, these wooden letter blocks that match up with them. And here I'd simply ask you to note the neon letter R in this painting. We will be returning to neon and its surprising connection to print and reversal several times later in this lecture. Robert Rauschenberg was also a great student of reversal, and here we might just return for a moment to the hoarfrost editions, which we looked at last week in terms of pressure, to note the way they show an incredible sensitivity to the perpetual reversals in print media. These are details from the work Mule, which has fields of wrinkled and fragmented text oriented mostly backwards. These are essentially transfer prints from newspapers, which of course originally read the right way, but because they're transferred in a press, they read the wrong way when they come out on the print. So most of the text is backwards, but there is also some right-facing text in this print. Here's a good example. We see part of an Andy Capp comic strip that's backwards, but also a moment of legible text in the bottom of the bag. Looking at jumbles like this, you realize that everything there that is now backwards was once forwards, and vice versa. The backwards comic strip was forwards on the copy of the LA Times from which it was transferred, but it was backwards on the printing plate that printed the newspaper itself, and was presumably forwards on the original line art, which became the print in the newspaper. Rauschenberg captures the way that information switches in and out of reversal as it moves between generations of media, the somersaulting dynamism of reversal that delivers to us virtually all printed matter. Today I'll be exploring printerly reversal and its implications, especially its dimensional implications. After a general introduction to the quiddities of reversal in printmaking, I'll focus on a group of contemporary artists who, like Johns and Rauschenberg, move fluently between printmaking and other media. In particular, I'll be looking at artists who use reversed text in their work, and therefore create highly conspicuous reversals, while also clearly attaching that project of reversal to the rubric of communication and dialogue. And in doing so, they show how the reversals that are native to printmaking can generate critical interventions in social and political space. Printmakers and would-be printmakers need to be able to think and work backwards as they work on the matrix. They need to be able to imagine source images in reverse and to anticipate the printed image in what we might call pre-verse. Printmaker statements are full of testimony about the mindset and the body set that this requires. The engraver has to see everything reversed. You have to flip everything in your head. Indeed, reversal is one of the most essential ways that printmaking, to quote Johns again, makes your mind work in a different way. For highly skilled printmakers, reversal becomes automatic and natural after long repetition and practice. It becomes part of their tacit intelligence. But for everyone else, this flipping is not easy. Although we are beings with more or less symmetrical body parts, our experiential orientation to the world tends to lean in one direction, to settle itself into handed or sided routines and perceptions. Most of us are not, in fact, ambidextrous. Working in reverse on a matrix, as I have done several times in a print shop, is almost like an out-of-body experience. It pulls you out of all of your known postures and ways of thinking. It actually makes your body feel different, as if your arms and head aren't working properly. It's very similar to the deep disorientation that a left-hander feels holding a right-handed pair of scissors, or an American feels when traveling in a country where people drive on the left. Even the most accomplished artists who routinely make prints struggle with these reversals. Bijah Salmans, whose work featuring oceanscapes and starry skies, you may know, had this to say in a 2011 oral history she gave for the Museum of Modern Art. Quote, "The whole printmaking thing is the most irritating thing you can do. They're all backward. You have to turn your head backward because when you print it, it goes the other way. I'm a real right there person, you know, so it's very hard for me to be right there, but upside down and inside out or whatever." One might well ask why, given this evident discomfort. Shulman's has made so many prints over the course of her career, and I think the simplest answer is that, like many other contemporary artists that have engaged with printmaking, this disorientation is precisely the point of the operation for her. Contemporary artists often seek out the destabilization of printmaking because it forces them out of the technical facility that they have attained in, say, drawing, painting, or sculpture. As they enter that mirror world of printing, they're taken out of the bodily and conceptual complacency that comes along with their own skills, out of the comfort of their own internalized orientation to their work. This turn to printmaking as an experience of estrangement or difficulty became a common refrain as the print renaissance gained steam after the 1960s. The archives of the great print shops are full of accounts of artists discovering the value of printmaking as a way of interrupting mastery. One of my favorite examples is John Cage's first residency at Crown Point Press, where he explicitly sought out the disorientation of printmaking. For his first project there, he did a series of prints called 7-Day Diary, Not Knowing. He made one print per day for 7 days, each using a new and different printmaking technique. As he said, this would be, quote, an activity that would be characterized by my not knowing what I was doing, end quote. This is partly accounted for by the imperative toward de-skilling that took over contemporary art in the 1960s and 70s and onward. Making prints was a good way to refuse the kind of artisanal facility that was increasingly seen as bankrupt at the time. But it's more complicated than that because this was not so much a refusal of artisanal skill as it was an embrace of the destabilizing experience of confronting an unfamiliar set of artisanal skills. Also, in turning to print, contemporary artists are tapping into a centuries-old ethos in the West of the critical power of reversal. The mythology of printmaking in the West has long flirted with the idea that reversal provides access to special forms of otherness, eccentricity, and opposition. The ability to work and perceive in reverse has long been associated with a seer-like divination of alternative dimensions and forms. It's often coincident with mystery or secrecy, inasmuch as the reverse is thought to lurk as the invisible other side of any form. As Catherine Reeves writes in an excellent essay called The Revision of Printmaking, printmakers have the capability to see the dual nature of all images, texts, identities, which exist always as themselves and always as their mirror images. But this experience of reversal is not shared with the rest of the art world, nor with society. This experience further marks the printmaker and printmaking as other, as eccentrics, those who do not occupy the center. We've already talked a bit about how printmaking is associated with critique, assessment, judgment, and justice through the work of Willie Cole. All of these impulses are also attached to the process of reversal. In this case, let's think again about the concept of the proof, which I raised briefly last week. In printmaking, the term proof is used to designate a trial or preliminary impression taken to be checked for errors and marked for correction before subsequent revision or final printing. It designates the production of a reversal as an act of testing and correction, and thus it is that reversal lurks as well behind the broader concept of proof as the establishment or demonstration of truth or validity or authenticity. To reverse something is either to validate it or to expose its weaknesses, to prove or disprove it. Now, a good example of these dynamics, inspired but not contained by the print medium, is Glenn Ligon's ongoing series of neon sculptures that subject the word America to various forms of reversal. Ligon is not primarily known as a printmaker, but his work is inseparable from the life of print, especially typographic print. His signature paintings, as many of you may know, involve texts printed with stencils. And here is an earlier work to give you an idea of the way print is essential to his entire career. Now, in these neon sculptures, Ligon turns letters backwards as well as upside down and flips them from front to back. In the context of proof, we can see this as a kind of testing or proofing of America, looking at it from both sides and checking on whether the image of America is sound. Hint, it really isn't. In this work, for example, each letter is reversed around its own axis. But because of the way the letters have internal symmetry planes, only some of them are obviously reversed, the C, the R, and the E. The reorganization of the letters through reversal reveals other latent meanings hiding in the word. The word crime, for example, begins popping out of this text as if it were hidden in the word America, an effect only evident because the letters are reversed. I also see the word acrimony in this piece. In this work, an upside-down America reads right way up only as a wavering reflection on the floor in a blood red. There is something sinister about this reflection. I'll return to Ligon later, but for now I want to linger on this notion of the sinister that is part of reversal. The critical power of reversal has long carried shades of the sinister. Those of you who are book historians know that the term printer's devil, slang for an apprentice in a print shop, may have derived from an earlier belief that a devil or devils haunted every print shop, causing various forms of mischief, but especially inverting letters. Moreover, the very term sinister derives from the traditional denomination of left and right as sinister and dexter. Whether conceived of as sinister or merely mischievous, the point is that reversal engenders critique, a refusal to accept the status quo, and the insight that every form is accompanied by its reverse. Now, Ligon's work takes reversal off of the plane and puts it in space. So each letter here is suspended a little bit away from the wall, and the light and reflections from the neon project into the architecture of the room. Ligon, in other words, treats these printerly reversals in an inherently sculptural way. But in doing so, he's not so much adding space to reversal as he is exploiting the way that reversal always already generates spatial effects. He's making visible something that's already latent deep in the work of print, namely that reversal can be seen as a sculptural or architectural process. Now, I want to turn to some of the ways in which reversal can do this, can produce space, including social space. Even looking at something like this reversed letter, which takes on the simplest form of reversal that you can get between a matrix and a print, there is a kind of extra space being generated here. This mirror relation that we're looking at is carving out an activated space around itself. This form of mirror pairing is known as chiral. The term chiral comes from the Greek word meaning hand, and it's also commonly used to refer to the left and right-handed forms that exist throughout the natural world, those that lean or spiral in opposite directions, so actual hands, certain crystals and shells, spiral galaxies, certain stereoisometric molecules, etc. This mirroring seems simple enough when you just look at it, but what makes it interesting for us in this spatial context is that this kind of mirroring always implies an extra dimension. So let me explain what I mean by that. Even though it's obvious that these two E's are closely related to each other as they sit on this 2D plane, they cannot actually be superimposed on each other or brought together on this plane. So take the E on the left. No matter how vigorously or creatively you scooch it around on this page, you cannot bring it into alignment with the E on the right. In order to do that, you have to flip it up and over off the page and into three-dimensional space. You have to imagine it pivoting around a kind of hinge into another dimension, in this case, the N plus one dimension or the third dimension. By the way, if you want to bring mirrored 3D forms into alignment, like a left spiraling snail shell and a right spiraling snail shell, you have to rotate them in four-dimensional space. This is one of my favorite stories, but a story for another day. So this way of implying 3D space on a 2D plane is fundamentally different than the way spatial suggestion is normally handled in the tradition of Western representational painting with its histories of perspective and illusionism. This is why Jasper Johns was attracted to reversal. One of the reasons he turned to print was because it gave him ways of evoking complex spatial experiences without resorting to optical perspective or traditional illusionism. So reversal creates an implied space through its generation of mirrored forms. At the same time, it can also generate another kind of reversal, a reversal across the picture plane from front to back, and the creation of a relationship between the space in front and the space behind that plane. Jasper Johns again provides an excellent illustration of this. Consider the lithograph Skin with O'Hara poem of 1965. Johns made this print by pressing and rolling his hands and face across the surface of a lithographic stone, and then printing it. What's most conspicuous about this image is not so much the left-right reversal, but the reversal across the plane. In the making of the face and hand prints, John's, of course, was always on this side of the stone, right? No matter how hard he smashed his face against it, he could never pass through it. And in fact, it was that very obdurate resistance of the surface, and we talked last week a little bit about the resistance from below that's part of print. It was that very resistance that made the printed mark possible. But in the print that issues from this activity, his image suddenly seems to have leapt over to the other side of that impermeable barrier. The same pressing and pushing of the artist's body on this side now appears to be coming from that side of the surface. And as many commentators have noticed, it appears to be locked there. As Kirk Varnadeau put it, it's, quote, a figure trapped and desperately trying to push forward from a space behind the surface, end quote. Reversed by the press, the mark looks back at the artist from a space of quarantine that is inescapably other. So the image leaves the immediate sphere of the artist and returns in reversed form. The press takes the artist's gesture and bounces it back backwards. The image returns from a different perspective, as if from a distant mirror on the other side of the universe. It's his mirror image, but it is not quite himself. This has had an immense appeal for Johns from the outset. He has repeatedly spoken of his desire to detach images from his own specific subject position. Quote, I want an image to be free from the way I see it. Or, as he has said, things become other when you look at them backwards. So for Johns, the reversal generated by the press can serve as a device for the automatic generation of alterities or otherness. It splits apart the singular viewpoint of the artist and opens up a relational circuit with some other side. It installs an alter ego through reversal and separation. It really puts someone else on the other side of the picture plane. This essentially activates both sides of the picture plane through reversal and suggests a model for thinking of the print as a dynamic, dialogic surface that creates and structures relationships with an other. Now, this simultaneous left, right, and front, back reversal, the way one generates the other, holds enormous possibility for critical artistic exploration. The artist that has taught me the most about how to develop that social potential of that splitting across the picture plane is the artist Carita Kent. Now, Kent was a prodigious screen print artist in Los Angeles in the 1960s and 70s. She was also a Roman Catholic nun, where she helped run the famous art program at Immaculate Heart College in Hollywood. In the mid-1960s, a strong progressive energy was running through world Catholicism, a wave of reforms attempting to modernize the faith and its practices. These included the use of vernacular languages instead of solely Latin for the liturgy, and encouragement for Catholics to become more involved in local causes. Inspired by this, along with the first stirrings of pop art in New York and Los Angeles, Kent began a series of remarkable screen prints that fused the vernacular energies of pop and progressive Catholicism. So Kent's prints are full of text, and they're also full of double meanings. She left her slogans and brand names attached to a kind of commercial context, but also appropriated them for their spiritual and aesthetic resonances. So a print like this is referring both to Wonder Bread in a pop art way, but also wonder in a religious sense at the same time. One of the most distinctive aspects of Kent's prints are the reversals to which she subjected these words. There are many different ways that she did this, but let's just focus on the backwards texts. Many of the texts in her prints read backward as if seen in a mirror, like the red text in this print that says appropriately, turn, turn. But although this is a typical mirror reversal that you'd see in printmaking, Kent did not talk about it in terms of mirrors and reflections. Instead, she claimed that when you look at backwards text, you're seeing the words as if from behind, from the other side of the letters. As she said on several occasions, it's necessary to turn the words over to see what's on the other side. Now, with this idea of reversal, Kent is inching toward the kind of cross-plane reversal that we've just discussed with the Johns print. She implies that reversing words from left to right also suggests a kind of flipping over of the print or page or screen, viewing or occupying it from the other side. And for her, this was a fundamental way of thinking about the act of empathy in printmaking. Now, before going any further, I want to point out that Kent's chosen medium of screen printing is not quite like other print media that we've looked at so far in the way it handles the whole project of reversal. We've been talking about processes like etching and engraving that produce images by forcing ink to move from the face of an opaque obdurate plate or stone onto the face of the support or paper. The screen printing matrix, by contrast, is a soft, transparent mesh through which ink is pushed with a rubber squeegee to the paper below. The mesh is impregnated with or adhered to a stencil, which acts as a kind of negative, blocking the passage of ink through parts of the screen and thereby generating the image. Now, I'll talk a lot more about screen printing in the coming weeks, but for our purposes today, this means that the image on the matrix is not reversed as it passes through to the paper or support. So if you look at this diagram, you can see that the W is the same way round on both planes. It's for this reason that screen printing is sometimes discussed as a non-reversing print medium. But, and this is a big but, just because there's no reversal on the scene of transfer doesn't mean that reversal doesn't inhabit the process. In fact, as Kent was very well aware, reversal is a prominent and inescapable part of screen printing. It's just that it occupies the process a little bit differently. Unlike traditional matrices, the screen print matrix is transparent. And because it's transparent, the reverse side of the screen and its stencils are always visible and available to the artist. In fact, while working, the artist cannot help but confront the other side or backside of these images or texts. Reversed inscriptions are constantly available to view as the artist opens and closes the hinge of the screen. And here I'll note that we're looking at a hinge again. Or as the artist engages in processes to prepare the matrix. This is a screen washing operation. In fact, the reverse surface of the screen is usually the surface on which the artist actively works, as here in a still from a period film featuring Kent's work, where we can see her working on the reverse side of the screen from the other side. So let's review the difference here between, say, engraving and screen print in their access to an approach to reversal. So with engraving, the right and reversed versions of the image are distributed across two different objects, the matrix and the print. But in the screen print, both of these forms have essentially been collapsed together into the matrix alone. Through transparency, the screen matrix holds both of these versions in the same object. To make them switch from one to the other, one only need look at the screen from one side or the other, or imagine doing so. Screen printing is a 20th century invention, for the most part. And while this magical doubleness of the transparent matrix may seem like a wholly newfangled way of managing reversal, the fact is that it's not completely disconnected from earlier printing methods in copper, wood, or stone. In fact, it's possible to see it as a continuation of various reversal techniques that permeated these earlier methods. One of the key problems in any traditional print shop was how to preserve the original orientation of an artist's design in the final print. Take this beautiful drawing of fossil ammonites by the British scientist Robert Hooke. Now, if you want the shells to spiral in their original direction when they're printed, you need somehow to transfer this drawing to the matrix in reverse. The drawing needs to be backwards on the plate in order to face in the correct direction again on the print. This is why the reverse of a drawing or design was a perpetual object of desire in the world of printmaking. But how do you get that? How do you just reverse a drawing? How would you turn it around? You couldn't, until very recently, just flip it around in Photoshop. And it wasn't very efficient to laboriously redraw the entire thing backwards by squaring it off or eyeballing. It was difficult enough that printmakers often simply didn't bother. The printer of Hooke's drawing didn't bother, which is why all of these beautiful shell fossils are facing the wrong way in the published engraving. This, by the way, was a common fate befalling the illustration of shells in the Age of Enlightenment. It's too bad, because while it may not matter to humans which way a shell is spiraling, it certainly matters to the shells. Anyway, one solution to the problem of reversing a drawing that was commonly arrived at for centuries across multiple different processes was to find a way of essentially making the drawing transparent so that it could be seen from the other side and therefore seen in reverse. And this is one of the reasons that trace paper was actually invented or devised. Various methods were used, for example, soaking paper in oil, turpentine, or naphtha, in order to make it transparent. So a drawing on a paper like this, a transparent sheet, could be held up to a window and traced from the back, essentially creating a reversed image, and then transferred to the plate in the usual manner. You can reverse an image, in other words, by looking at its other side. Left-right reversal and front-back reversal are equivalent. Another way of transparentizing an image for reversal was pricking or poncing, pricking tiny holes along the outlines, creating a literally perforated sheet in which the basic contours of the reversed image could be made available by simply flipping the sheet around. On these oiled or perforated sheets, the drawing is able to appear on both sides of the sheet simultaneously and therefore become reversible. The sheet holds both sides of a mirror image suspended in a single form. As common transfer tools in every print shop, these sheets teach us something fundamental about print. Any image in print implies or derives from or carries along its own reversal. And these sheets, again, are embodiments of the constant desire and necessity for reversal in all printmaking processes. And this is one of the things that they have bequeathed to modern techniques like screen printing. So a useful way to think of screen printing is essentially that these intermediary tools of older printmaking media, these sort of delicate reversing interfaces, have simply migrated into the position of the matrix itself. Screen printing is a continuation of these processes, not a radical break from them. Now, Carita Kent understood this very old principle of reversal and transparency, and she understood that it could be used as a way of creating critical social space. When we see the screen of screen printing as a form of reversing transparency, as we have been doing, we're also then able to see how closely it relates to Kent's other forms of transparent image media that were part of her work. One of these, of course, was film, a 20th century medium with transparent stock that holds an image in both right and reversed forms. Another was the 35 millimeter slide. Kent used slides constantly in her work. The Kodak carousel projector was introduced in 1962. Anyone in my audience who remembers using a Kodak carousel projector will remember how easy it was to misload a slide and find yourself with a reversed image on the screen. Another medium, perhaps less obvious, was the store window, especially the grocery store window, which was a site of inspiration for her pop-inspired imagery. The window is a key site for images and letters that can be viewed from inside or outside, before or behind. So all of these media then, store window, film, 35 millimeter slide, and screen printing, are communications media that spatially organize communities. Kent's genius was to recognize that the transfer and transformation that's synonymous with reversal in print could be imagined in connection with these more sculptural or architectural technologies. Like the store window or the slide, the screen print matrix generates a spatial and social relationship between inside and outside, before and behind. Although this screen matrix can only be seen from one side at a time, its transparency permits you to imagine taking a position on the other side or to visualize someone else in that position. And this is especially true when you approach the backside of a screen matrix where the lettering is in reverse, because the act of attempting to read the words backwards forces you as the viewer to virtually inhabit the reversed position from which the words would be read correctly. I would even go so far as to propose that the screen matrix inherently conjures the presence of another person viewing it from the other side, creating a dialogic milieu around itself, which serves as a kind of mediating surface for a social relationship. Now, what interests me about Kent's prints is the way they carry this vision of a transparent dialogic screen through to the final print itself. So, of course, the final prints that she makes are not transparent, they're opaque. But the reversed words virtually perforate that picture plane and evoke this matrix of interchange. For her, that interchange was named communion, and this was, of course, a Catholic way of thinking about interchange. Communion between conversants who are facing each other. This does not, however, correspond to some model of easy synthesis or palliative harmony. Kent's printed texts with their reversals inherently split the community of readers, even as they suggest their conjunction. Kent's surfaces retain the friction of difference and even opposition, while they also produce a congregation of those viewpoints. The reverse texts conjure the other, but the other is estranged, defamiliarized, backwards. The other, like Jasper Johns's face, is over on the other side. And at the same time, these prints train us to imagine our own estrangement, our own reversal from the other side of the page. So if these are sites for communal understanding, they can produce that understanding only by first acknowledging what Claire Bishop calls a moment of mutual non-identification. Now, as models of interaction occurring through and upon screens, Kent's prints have obvious resonances with our own contemporary lives, especially over the last year when virtually all of our social lives have been conducted through screens. But her reversals are more radical in their acknowledgement of difference and otherness than almost anything that we're used to in our contemporary screen experience. We speak of interacting in social networks through our screens, of course, but the disorienting reversals that Kent saw as inherent to the work of print have been mostly expunged from our devices. So, for example, when we exchange texts, our experience of the letters on the screen tends to absorb us into an illusion of shared orientation. After all, we're all looking at the letters on our screens in the same way. Imagine instead what texting would be like if your friend's texts came to you in reverse. Only then would you be participating in a spatial network that recognizes otherness in anything like what Kent had imagined and what the reversals at the heart of print might truly suggest. A reversed text suspended on a veil between different parts of the social body provides a shared plane of communication and opportunity for dialogue, but does not assume or demand that both sides share precisely the same perspective. So we have reversal as alterity, critique, judgment, relationality, estrangement, displacement. These powers of reversal run, whether as latent potential or actual agency, through every print and every printmaking process. A look around contemporary art will turn up several examples of artists who, like Kent, and often explicitly inspired by Kent, have used textual reversal to harness these dynamics. I've already mentioned Ligon, but now that we've been talking about the relationship between transparency and reversal a little more, we can better understand the way Neon is working as an adjunct to print in his work. Think of the quintessential space for a neon sign, a window suspended between inside and outside, usually of a place like a bar or a restaurant that evokes comfort and community and belonging, at least to those who feel like they belong there, at least to those who are not excluded. A neon sign is like a text on a silkscreen or trace paper. You could see it from the front or the back, and depending on which side of the window you're on, you see it differently. Ligon's neon pieces explicitly position the idea of America as something that has an inside and an outside. That tension, which is usually suppressed in our national mythologies, that tension leaps into view through the critical power of reversal. There are many other examples of the way these printerly reversals can speak to the problem of space, community, and belonging. This very recent work by the artist Virgil Abloh is literally a silkscreen, with the words, "Watch your back," stenciled both forwards and backwards into the mesh. Not only does this create an exaggerated expression of the double-sided reversibility of all silkscreens, it also speaks to the way that that reversibility, when understood as an analog for the body, can express a sense of acute vulnerability. If either side can be the front or the back, then theoretically both sides can be the back and convey the attendant sense of 360-degree vulnerable exposure to power and violence. Ed Ruscha is another artist to bring in here. He has been famously working with palindromes and other reversal wordplay for decades. His work, which has always developed in and through print as well as painting, is incredibly canny in the connections it draws between reversibility and spatial experience. To give just one example, here's a work titled Oh Ho that might serve as a kind of mascot for this entire lecture because it explicitly interprets the act of word reversal as equivalent to rotation and inversion in space. Here's a work related to that project in which Ruscha has added his signature along both the top and the bottom of the image to indicate that he considers the work to be vertically reversible. So one day you can hang it as ho, and the next day you can hang it as o. This, of course, is playful, but there is also a kind of terror lurking in it. Like Abloh's screen, it suggests vulnerability because we realize here how thoroughly our experience of language, the supposedly stable space of sharing and communication, depends upon our specific spatial orientation. These words have no stable meaning apart from our individual perspectives on them. Another necessary inclusion in this lecture is Deborah Cass's very well-known recent sculpture, Oi Yo. Here it is as it was installed in 2015 in Brooklyn Bridge Park. Cass is a printmaker well-trained in the adventure of reversal. These two letters, O and Y, reverse when walked around, changing not only in sound, but also in meaning, in both cultural referent and in audience, changing from Spanish to Yiddish, from urban slang for a greeting to urban slang for dismay, and so on. The front and back of the word are undecidable. It's not clear which is the front and which is the back. This is a piece of freestanding typography that both refers to and actively generates a community that coheres, but retains its differences, and it retains a sense of equality in its differences. Bruce Nauman is another artist who's deeply invested in printmaking and its implications, especially reversal, although he tellingly calls it not reversal, but front-back interplay. In some cases, as with Ruscha, these reversals are playful or punning, such as aha here. Note this is a screen print, so it's replicating the experience of the double-sided matrix in many different ways. But more generally, Nauman's work plumbs the darker side of reversal. Like Ligon, his disorienting reversals of text are often pursued simultaneously in neon and in print, both of which, as the critic John Yao puts it, throw Nauman's words into a, quote, continuously irritated condition, end quote, while also implying double perspectives and conflict. Nauman's interest in the profundity of reversal actually first developed in his sculpture practice in graduate school, where he found himself as interested in the molds and negative spaces of the objects he made as he was in the objects themselves. A work such as A Cast of the Space Under My Chair demonstrates the eerie sense of disorientation that follows from the reversal of positive and negative space. It also inaugurates another of Nauman's long-standing motifs, the suspended and reversed chair. Like printmaking itself, these upside-down and inside-out chairs suggest displacement and a loss of security and stability. In much of his work, these chairs explicitly refer to torture and to the condition of the disappeared. John Yao has said that in observing these, we learn about what it means to be deprived of gravity, orientation, and privacy. This is not to equate printmaking with torture, but the process and its reversals does open out to these disorienting deprivations and estrangements, and it makes it a medium uniquely suited to working through these ideas. Finally, I want to linger on the work of Edgar Heap of Birds, a Cheyenne Arapaho artist who lives and works in Oklahoma. He uses reversal very effectively in his work, much of which is emphatically text-based. He recently designed the cover of Art in America, and note the way the word America is reversed. And the cover featured one of a series of short and painful monotype prints that he had been working on, prints with texts that contend with the destruction of Native American culture that haunts American history. His word work is a kind of fragmented poetry. It alludes to vernacular signs, protest posters, but most importantly, it points to the history and ongoing presence of state violence against Native communities. Each of these is a monotype, which means there's only one copy of it. Each is created by writing backwards on a plate. So each of these, in each of these, the texts originate in reverse and help us to see how central that reversal and the spatiality of print is for his work. These are made by coating an acrylic plate with ink, into which Heap of Birds writes the text in reverse with his finger. It does not become legible in the correct orientation until the print is pulled from the plate, although you can also see it in the correct orientation when you're looking at the plate and you reverse it. So in this case, it's a transparent matrix like the screen print is. Meanwhile, however, in Working in Reverse, Heap of Birds engages in an act of communication with a white American audience in which he refuses to fully inhabit the orientation of the English language, to fully inhabit that space. His enunciation comes literally from an oppositional perspective, from the other side, from a space of critique and judgment. If you know his work, you may have seen a sign from his series called Native Hosts, which has been ongoing since the late 1980s. These are commercially printed signs that masquerade as official road signs. They're site-specific and all have the same structure. For each sign, the English place name of the site is printed in reverse, followed by the words, "Today your host is," and the name of the indigenous tribe that is native to that area. And in many cases, there will be multiple signs for each place, corresponding to the multiple different tribes that might have been associated with it. Heap of Birds claims that, quote, "The real mission of my art is to reset history." And I'd argue that it's the reversal of printed text in these works that does a lot of that work, allowing that to happen. The history that needs resetting is the historical imaginary of American settler colonialism and its orientation towards the indigenous peoples who were relocated in order to form the American state. As codified around the 19th century doctrines of manifest destiny and the vanishing race, the march of Anglo-European civilization was presented as a progressive westward sweep before which the indigenous populations had no choice but to vanish. This is an imaginary which treats indigenous peoples as the so-called vanishing race, with the violence of that process obscured under a romantic narrative of inevitable rather than forced decline. All of this is perfectly embodied in this turn-of-the-century photograph by Edward S. Curtis. As Curtis's photograph suggests, the whole vanishing race ideology is already a kind of road sign, a directional indicator. The Navajo here are leaving the scene, retreating away from us into a fuzzy pictorialist space in the distance. We look into a picture space, an indigenous presence there is one of moving away, retreating, receding. We're in the space of enunciation and vision, as if our perspective itself was driving these figures away. This is a one-way process. Heap of Birds' reversed text, with startling efficiency, resets, repopulates, and unsettles this picture. Part of this comes from the way the signs use language to reinstall the indigenous tribes in the present, for example, by insisting on the word today. It also insists on the presence of indigenous voices before settlers by presenting them as hosts for arriving visitors. But the reverse text does all this even more pointedly, generating, as in Carita Kent's work, a double directionality that meets along the plane of the sign. This is a live and present encounter, a confrontation with voices converging from two different directions. The settler finds her place name reversed, estranged, voiced from the other side. Now, inasmuch as the threat to Native sovereignty in American history was synonymous with the loss of land, this installation of a two-way dialogue also does something very important in terms of position and placement. The reversals, which open spaces on either side of the plane, give the indigenous speaker a place to stand. A location in the present, in active dialogue with the reader, not retreating, but standing and standing up through reversal. Okay, that's it for this week. Thank you again for watching, and thank you for watching all the way through to the end. Next week, we will have separation. Thanks again.